And now please help me welcome Kathy Herod this morning with us.
Guess I better turn it on. Well, thank you, and thanks for joining us this morning. You know, it's something called, what, International Women's Day, and what, women aren't supposed to be working, and you're supposed to not spend any money. So what does that make me want to do? Work as hard as I possibly can today and spend as much money as I possibly can today. I think that's the way I respond to International Women's Day, is what my thinking was this morning. I want to just do a few opening remarks before we get to the main event. I first want to make sure everyone, it's an answer to prayer at Center for Arizona Policy. Michael Clark has joined us as our new legislative counsel, so everyone welcome Michael. Michael comes to us most recently from being a law clerk for Arizona Supreme Court Justice Andy Gould. He, before that, of course, law school, but before that, interestingly enough, he has a PhD in world religion from Southern Seminary. And I share that because it's one of those examples of, you know, we want to get more engaged in what should CAP be doing on worldview at this point in time. And here God brings us someone who's got a worldview background. So I love these reminders from the Lord that he's not forgotten us. Because sometimes at the Capitol, you can almost wonder. Not really. But let me just mention, one thing I would ask for you to pray for is this afternoon at 2 o'clock, the House Judiciary Committee is going to hear the bill we have to protect doctors and nurses from discrimination in employment regarding end-of-life issues. And what we're seeing at the Capitol, no surprise, but how much the opposition is trying to distort and mislead and lie about every issue we are dealing with. So on the end-of-life rights of conscience bill, it's that doctors would be able to ignore loved ones' dying wishes. No, that's not what the bill would do. But it would say the doctor or the nurse who doesn't want to provide XYZ treatment that could cause death, that some kind of end-of-life provision, that they are protected from being demoted, from being fired, from being challenged in their employment, that they can still follow their beliefs, just like a doctor or nurse can regarding abortion. So that's up at 2 o'clock. It's already passed the Senate. We anticipate a favorable House Judiciary outcome today. Next week, next Wednesday, on the 15th, we'll have the Delivered Alive bill. And I'm not going to go into a lot of these details. We've got our fact sheets, but I encourage you to go on our bill tracker at our website. But the Delivered Alive bill, we've had the best way to describe this is a tragic story in Arizona where a baby survived an abortion, was left basically to die for an hour. The baby was about a pound, was about 22 weeks, 3 days, and nothing was done to save this precious child. The baby was basically left to die. So we in law enforcement, we've had a law in the books since 1975 that says you have to use all medical skills and means available to take care of a child in this circumstance. But it obviously was ignored, and so we, law enforcement, said we need to beef up our law, we need to change it, so we're doing that. And what they're saying about that bill is that it would apply to all births, and so it's somehow cruel that a child who's only going to survive, whatever the issue is, that it's better to wrap the child up, give comfort care to the child, let mom hold the child until the child passes, rather than try to help the child survive and give the child any kind of life-saving means. Much of the conflict that's coming on both of these bills are people that don't like current law. And what it's unveiling, as much as anything, is current laws not being followed. And so there's a lot being uncovered through these bills. So if you know of any stories of babies who have been born before 24 weeks, let us know. We're looking for those stories. And everyone thinks that you can't do an abortion in Arizona after 24 weeks. That is not the law. The law is that if the baby could survive outside the womb, you can't do the abortion unless it's for the life or the health of the mother. And now the health of the mother is a huge exception, but still, abortion clinics are advertising abortions through 23 weeks, 6 days, and we know babies are surviving at 22 weeks. So right there, we know the likelihood that some of these babies can survive an abortion, and they better be taking care of them. So that's the bill we've got up next week. And then we also have a homeschool bill next week. If any of you are homeschool people, homeschool students who are 18 and trying to get a job at daycare centers have been told they have to have a high school diploma. But when they come in with their homeschool high school diploma, they say that's not good enough. It needs to be a public school or a GED or something like that. So this law will say, no, no, no. The homeschool high school diploma qualifies as a diploma, and you can hire these people for daycare jobs and other similar type jobs. So just fixing that problem in the law. And I won't go into the school choice issue a lot today, but if any of you have questions or concerns about what's going on with empowerment scholarship accounts, what we are trying to do is expand ESAs to basically any public or charter school student would be eligible for an ESA to go to the school their parents choose after a phase-in of about 4 years. A lot of what's being said about that bill isn't accurate. But this is where we believe, at CAP, we believe that it's up to the parents how they educate their child. So we want parents to have a wide range of choices, whether it's public, charter, online, homeschool, public school, all those choices. And so we want to support parents in those choices. Votes are extremely close. And this is the year, if we are going to do a more broad school choice, you know, we've been a leader in school choice, but if we're going to have school choice with every child being eligible for school choice, it's going to have to be this year. The political dynamics, next year it's an election year, and then you kind of go beyond, this is the year to get it done. So we're hopefully going to be able to get that done. So just wanted to give you that little bit of an update. And then, you know, when I heard that John Stone Street was going to be in town, I said, well, let's have breakfast if you have time. And then I said, well, what if I invite a few other people to breakfast? And he graciously agreed. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with John, but he's spoken at pastors' conferences for us. We've done other events with him. And let me just mention that he is president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and the Breakpoint Radio co-host. And if you are not following Breakpoint, you need to. It is one of the don't miss emails, and if you whether you do it, whether you listen to it or get it via email, it's one of the don't miss emails to keep up with what's going on in the culture, and especially how to communicate in today's culture. He is, before that, some of you are familiar with Summit Ministries. John was the executive director at Summit Ministries. He was a Bryan College faculty member. He's got his master's from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and as I've said in the emails that we've sent out, he's one of the leading thinkers, I believe, of our time on what's going on in the culture and all things biblical. So join me in welcoming John up here.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. It's good to see all of you. And I joke that God loves me and Kathy has wonderful plans for my life, at least when I come to Phoenix. So you have a lot of friends. It's good to see everyone.
Yeah. Our friends at Alliance Defending Freedom would say the same thing. If I hear they've got somebody in town, okay, what else can we do? Why don't you just first share a little bit about Colson Center and what you've got going on at Colson Center so everybody knows.
Yeah, so the Colson Center obviously is named after Chuck Colson, one of the great Christian statesmen of the last generation. In fact, I want to recognize Steve and Tina Bradford, who are in the back of the room. They're here actually from the East Coast, but they're on grandparent duty here in Phoenix for a couple months, and so they stopped by this morning. Steve and Tina have worked with us for a long time and just recently stepped out of the organization. But the Colson Center really reflects the last 20 years of Chuck Colson's life, thought process, and approach to ministry. You know the story of Chuck. He was embroiled in the Watergate scandal, came to Christ right before all of that really blew up, and then ended up going to prison. Came out of prison, started Prison Fellowship Ministries, which became the largest ministry to families and individuals who are facing incarceration, dealing with prison, dealing with reentry into society in the world. But he started to ask some upstream questions. In other words, this was a time in culture where the prison population was going from about 200,000 in the 1970s to today over 2.2 million. And so the question is, why? And, of course, a lot of the traditional explanations are it's poverty, it's education, it's racism, it's this. And all of those things certainly factor into it, and certainly the war on drugs and mandatory sentencing laws and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, Chuck's baloney detector, in which he had a really good one, kind of sniffed out and said, no, there's something else here. What's happening in the culture? What's happening in the breakdown of the family? What's upstream creating the sort of brokenness that's being reflected in the prisons? And so that led him to, you know, read some of the greats, Augustine, Abraham Kuyper. He studied with Carl Henry. And all of these individuals pointed to this idea of worldview. That what you deeply believe, your most deeply held beliefs, reflect themselves in how you live as a community and as a people and then in the culture. And so our breakdown of worldview was leading to a breakdown of society, which was leading to an explosion in the prison population. And so that's when he started Breakpoint, right? Many of you remember his voice. It's funny, when I was I don't know if I told you this, but when I was a senior in high school was the first year Chuck came on radio, and my mom was a serially addicted listener to Moody Radio.
Pregnancy center worker too, right? Do I remember that right?
Your mom? Oh yes, my mom was it. Yeah, she ran a pregnancy. Yeah,
so good mom is why I'm saying
that's
that.
That's right. I come from good stock, but I remember hearing Chuck come on the radio, and I knew, and if you ever grew up in a home listening to Moody Radio, you know, you don't really have a clock. You just know, like, okay, when's Dobson on, or when's Kennedy off, and then you knew when to go to school, right? So it was when when Chuck was on was when I knew I needed to be headed to the car. So it's just really funny. I just remember that distinct voice, and then got to know Chuck over the last couple years of his life, and work with him and travel with him, and so about a year and a half ago. Sorry, this is longer than what you wanted, but about a year and a half ago, the Colson Center became a separate organization from Prison Fellowship, and what was just a decision that both organizations knew needed to happen. It's hard to talk about things like what we talk about, same-sex marriage, transgender issues, and still get into California prisons. And so it made a lot of sense for those two organizations to become separate. And so that happened about 18 months ago. We continue Breakpoint. Eric Metaxas and I do that every day. You can sign up for the email or catch us on radio if you listen to Christian radio. Or you can get it at breakpoint.org is the website to get those daily commentaries.
I also would encourage you to check out Wilberforce Weekend. That is at the end of May.
It's almost full.
My husband and I are going. We've been signed up for over a month. So I encourage you, if you've got a weekend in May, look it up. But it'll be a really interesting weekend and challenging and everything else. So we're looking forward to that. And I encourage you, I will just share, I believe so much in what John is doing that, you know, I've become a donor. So I think it's a ministry very worthy of support. You live in Colorado, so I have to start by asking you about how's it going with assisted suicide and recreational marijuana?
Oh, what could go wrong? Which one do you want first?
Well, assisted suicide was approved by the voters in Colorado in
That's
November.
Right.
And the reason I want to bring this up is because it is a issue here that if it were on the ballot in Arizona, I am not convinced we could defeat it, that it'd be more likely to pass. So we have got to be educated on what's wrong with physician-assisted suicide.
You know, Kathy, what stunned me, and we really jumped in, we mobilized all of our Colorado Colson Fellows. We have a one-year in-depth, deep dive worldview training program that we offer every year, and I'll talk more about that later. We have some of them in Colorado. We have Breakpoint listeners. We worked with folks on the family and your counterpart there in Colorado. The other side poured immediately over $5 million into that at a state-level initiative to get Prop 106 passed. I mean, it was amazing. And it traces back to Soros, which is an interesting idea as well. But this is one of the things that George Soros is really funding right now, is the state-level initiatives to push doctor-assisted death across America. It was so overwhelmingly easy to sell to a population that kind of skews libertarian, right? And also just a population that can't get past emotion to facts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There is not a more emotionally, a tugging sort of cause. Abortion's not. I mean, abortion, your heart goes to the child, the baby. When you start talking about doctor-assisted death, you have to get past the emotion to the facts of where this goes. You've got to be able to look across the ocean to Belgium and to the Netherlands. You've got to look north to Canada. There's interesting, fascinating things going on in Canada right now about this. We're about to write about a couple of these things that are happening in Canada since they've legalized doctor-assisted death. But you guys are right, by the way, and I want to commend you. I was thinking about that when you were going through your update. To get the religious freedom thing out in front. I mean, it wasn't just a year or so after the Canadian Medical Association, endorsed, got behind doctor-assisted death in Canada, that major medical journals were now saying that if doctors can't perform euthanasia, they can't participate, then they don't deserve to be doctors in Canada. If they can't provide care. And that's the language. And then the image that we see is the image of someone severely in pain all the time. It's interesting that the surveys that have been done in California, of course, Oregon, which of course they've had this for 20 years, it's less than 20% of patients choose doctor-assisted death because of pain management. So you got 80%, the vast majority are dealing because of emotional, psychological. They don't want to be a burden on their families. It's a story that came out of Belgium last month of a doctor administering to an Alzheimer's patient, so she's not able to choose it, and actually had to have the family hold the patient down while the doctor administered death. I mean, you know, we say slippery slope as if it, well, that's just a slippery slope argument, as if it doesn't happen. You know, I talked to Johnny Erickson Todd about this. You guys know Johnny, right? And she's a tremendous advocate for life on the other end, on the end of life. And she said, it is a slippery slope when we morally grease it. And, you know, it's downhill. That's what happens. And there is no more. When you remove all the barriers to human dignity on that end of life, yeah, religious freedom goes out the window. Patients' rights goes out the window. The right to die becomes the duty to die. We just saw yesterday with the House plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's still going to keep enough things in that whole system. I'm not a huge fan of this. Still going to keep enough things in the system that's going to financially incentivize people offing themselves. So when you start introducing finances, right? That's where you get the psychological issues where people feel like, well, I'm a burden to others. And that's what we're seeing on that.
So remind me, in Colorado, did Soros also pay to get signatures to get it on the ballot? Or was it a referral from the legislature?
This was a ballot thing. He paid to get signatures on the ballot. He had an office. There's a national organization that has state plants, and he has a state plant right there in D.C. And I remember talking to a lot of my friends who were really involved in the Colorado world, like you. I mean, and it was just amazing. They said, we're already down funding wise 3-4-1. So what it ended up being, Kathy, is commercials to pass Prop 106 were running for 3 months. Mm-hmm. The amount of money that could be raised. I'll tell you the other frustrating thing. I really kind of put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in Prop 106. Into fighting Prop 106. The other thing that was really frustrating is I couldn't get pastors to talk about it. My pastor did. He was heroic. I wish I could have recorded. He had just come from the bedside of a dying parishioner the week before he got up and talked about Prop 106. And it was beautiful. And it was exactly right that as Christians, we don't fear death. And death is one of the times that somebody can best love his or her family members and show them the right thing. It was just an amazing thing that he did. But I think the opposition to 106, we scrounged up just under 2 million, had enough to do, you know, basically 2 weeks of commercials right when the ballots came out. And it just, you know, we moved the needle a little bit, but it was so far the other way.
So this is an example of where elections matter. Every year in Arizona, there's a bill introduced to legalize doctor-prescribed death. The only reason it doesn't go anywhere is because we've got a Senate president and a House speaker that will bury those bills. And so, for example, in Arizona, we had 4 state Senate seats in play. If 3 of those 4 Senate seats had gone to the Democrats, and we're nonpartisan, but if the Democrats had been, you know, even in the state Senate or in control of the state Senate, we would have been having hearings on legalizing doctor-prescribed death in our state. And then on the George Soros, reason I ask about that, if you're not aware, Soros and his cronies put in about a million and a half to try to defeat Maricopa County Bill Montgomery because of how solid he is on all the issues that we care about. And so Soros at any moment could decide, hey, I got some extra millions to put into Arizona and put this on the ballot. The only way that recreational marijuana was really defeated in Arizona was, one, let me first say, pastors did speak up, and some of those pastors are here today. We had what we'd call the ground war with pastors so active against it. We were doing a lot on the ground war, and then we had a governor who raised $6 million to counter what the pro-recreational marijuana people were going to do. But that's not over. You know, the other side never stops, and we've got to have that same perseverance.
And to be clear, on Prop 106 in Colorado, that was doctor-assisted suicide had been taken to the legislature twice and had been defeated. And here's one of the interesting things about it. Elections do matter. The other thing that matters is everyday Christians being able to articulate to their friends and neighbors, very clear points. That's what we do every day on Breakpoint. We want to help everyday people be able to take stuff and use it. We don't want to be the sort of organization where you listen or you read our email and you think, wow, they're really smart. We want you to think, wow, I can use that tomorrow when I'm in a conversation with my sons and daughters. Because on doctor-assisted death, how it was defeated twice in the legislature, was that that's one of those issues where if you really sit down and you look all the way through it and you get past the emotion, it actually becomes quite obvious to the legislatures, the legislators who have a responsibility to defend, you know, conscience rights and the pressure that it would put on the medical system and the financial and the regulation. That's the big thing. Once this passes, it's impossible to regulate. Right? Because you start using these words where everyone, you know, starts using the same vocabulary but not the same dictionary, right? Like words like unbearable suffering. What does that mean? Have you ever met someone and you listen to their life and you think, I could have never survived the sort of pain and suffering that you, and yet they're just unbelievable. Have you ever met somebody like that? On the other hand, have you ever met someone who just is always about on the verge of death, but not? Right? I mean, unbearable suffering, there's not a more squishy, poorly defined word out there, and yet that's what all of this is based on. There has to be usually projections that someone's going to die within 60 days. Who's good at predicting that, right? I mean, how many of you had a loved one that far outlived a prognosis? How many of you had a loved one that didn't? This is just stuff you can't predict. And so basically, we're pretending in areas like we're omniscient. And those areas completely compromise physicians' rights, hospital rights, patients' rights, family rights. Who says? I mean, all of this stuff just gets completely muddled. And doctor-assisted suicide. So if you can actually take the time and walk through it, this is one of those, like abortion, right? I mean, this was the secret sauce of the pro-life movement, is let's actually get away from the hysteria and talking points, and let's look at what is the unborn. And then it became clear, and it's even becoming clear to the rest of America in many ways. We got to do the same thing here.
And in both of those situations, whether it's abortion or the end of life, doctors are trying to play God. When
man
knows not his time.
That's right.
And we don't know what babies are going to survive and how they're going to survive
right.
at early stages.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, you've got a new book coming out, so let's talk about that a little bit. What a practical?
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I have kids. They need to go to college. Let's talk about that.
And you can pre-order it on Amazon, and I've already done that.
Thank you.
But A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. If there's one deep, heartfelt concern, I think of everyone in this room and that we hear over and over again, is how do we reach our young people? And so when you say next, I mean, speak to that a little bit, but let me first define next generation. Are you saying minors under 18? Are you saying millennials too? Or just in, you know, what's your advice on how we raise up this next generation?
My co-author is Brett Kunkel. He and I really aim this at parents, mentors, teachers, anyone concerned about, you know, students. Okay, so let's say, you know, college students and below. But my interest really is, you know, the Colson Center has been completely lock-focused from, and we inherited this from Chuck, on this idea of Christians are supposed to engage the culture. The best way to engage the culture is to engage the next generation, because culture flips every generation. Not completely, right? But do you realize that all of you have a smartphone, or just about all of you have a smartphone, but that's less than 15 years old as a reality. Smartphones have completely changed culture in some very tangible ways, economic ways. No one knows how to use a map anymore, for example, right? I mean, you could just go down the list. That's not that long ago. And so when we, in a sense, we're also trying to call parents, grandparents, pastors, and so on, business leaders, to look after the next generation. If you really care about the future, right, you got to care about the next generation. We saw this, by the way, on the same-sex marriage issue, which was also, by the way, one of the impetus behind writing this book. But on the same-sex marriage issue, do you remember when we had so many marriage amendments passed in state after state after
30?
State? 30 to nothing. And there was this moment on Larry King Live where Larry King was asking a gay activist who was on his program, and I think at this point it was like 21 to nothing. It's like, you know, 21 straight state legislatures have passed a marriage amendment defining marriages between a man and a woman. You're losing 21 to nothing. Are you discouraged? And his response was, not at all. Because Will and Grace is the number one show on television. You see what he realized, right? That laws are downstream from culture. politics tends to be, not always, but mostly, is downstream from culture, right? And so we can have all the laws we want on the books right now if we don't have the hearts and minds of the next generation. And I mean just the Christian kids in the next generation, right? Then we're in for a world of hurt. And also, obviously, we should care about them because we love them, right? And if you love them, you should care about the ideas that take them captive. So that really was the drive behind it.
Okay, so somewhere that you mentioned Will and Grace, you're a father of three daughters.
Yes.
And a son on the way, correct?
Yes, I do. So, you know, there's a parable that Jesus tells about the persistent widow. Do you know that parable? where the widow just goes every day to the judge, and finally the judge is like, all right, those are my three daughters, right? So my daughters are 11, 9, and 7, and for 5 years they've been praying for a little brother. And they're getting one in May, so we're excited. But yeah. Okay.
So the controversy of the day on Facebook, if you haven't seen this yet, is Beauty and the Beast. So what are you doing with your three daughters and Beauty? I remember you talking about Frozen and how much you had to hear the Frozen song. So now it's going to be Beauty and the Beast. What are you doing about that gay character, and how are you handling that with your daughters? And advice.
Well, thanks for asking. I had we also do, in addition to Breakpoint, which is the daily thing, we do a thing called The Point, which is a 1 minute, and it's also on about half the radio stations, and we also use it on social media. So yesterday's point was about this, and it got me in a lot of trouble, right? A lot of trouble. And the backdrop, obviously, is, first of all, you have to understand if you have daughters or granddaughters, they've known about this remake, this real-life remake of Beauty and the Beast for about a year now. Is that right? Anybody else in that situation where you have a daughter? I mean, just been talking about it. Well, an announcement was made a couple weeks ago that there was going to be a gay moment in Beauty and the Beast. Did anybody see this story? That there's going to be a gay moment. Now, that could mean almost anything. Almost always what that means is that a movie, is some company, in this case Disney, is trying to throw a bone to the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. They're trying to get some brownie points with the audience, right? That's what they're trying to do, almost always. And almost always, because this isn't the first time, there was something in like How to Train Your Dragon 2, and there was also something in another film that was kind of like a gay moment. That was Pixar, but the other one. But anyway, almost always, it's a blink and you might miss it sort of thing, right? Introduced. But this is Beauty and the Beast. This is not How to Train Your Dragon 2. This will be one of the biggest movies of all time, right? This is the real-life remake of Beauty and the Beast has been highly anticipated now for a year. It's got Emma Watson from Harry Potter fame. This is not going to be a small thing. This is going to be a huge thing. And so immediately, there was a call to boycott. There was a call to do that. I have mixed feelings about boycotts. They sometimes work. They most often don't. And there's also the reality of, well, what do we mean by gay moment? Is this a gay moment like, is this going to be like huge, or is this going to be not at all? I mean, is it going to be a blink and you miss it, and they're just patting themselves on the back in order to get the HRC's kind of brownie points? And that's a good question. No one knows. Here's the other interesting thing about the gay moment is that you might, if you know the cartoon version of Beauty and the Beast, you might know which character it is. It's the one that, how many of you guys know Beauty? I have three daughters. I live in this, everything in my house has one of those stupid princesses on it. I mean, you guys know Beauty and the Beast in the story, and you've seen it. Okay, so there's Gaston, right? The arrogant guy that wants to... And then he's got that little friend, right? Right, LeFou. He's going to have the gay moment in the real-life remake, LeFou. Here's interesting, though, and no one's actually brought this up except one of our writers who's smarter than everybody that I've ever met, that you know what LeFou means in French? Yeah, it's the fool. I'm just going to let that sit, and you guys decide. I don't know if this is a win or not, you know. And there's always these lines of how soon is too soon, you know, and all that sort of stuff. What I posted is, there's calls to boycott. What I'm going to do, it's probably going to be a moment that if you blink, you miss it. What I'm going to do is I'm not going to let my daughters blink and miss it. We'll watch it, and then I'm going to point it out, and then we're going to have a conversation about it. Because I think, it's not going to be anything explicit. There's not going to be any sexuality. It's going to be an attraction and kind of a goofy in love stuff. Because A, that's what we do with almost all of our movies and all of our shows and all the commercials. When a moment pops up, whether we like it or not, we stop and we have a conversation. And the main reason is we live, as we say in the book, in the age of information, where kids on a daily basis get bombarded with more information than any other generation in history, right? Our kids encounter more information in a daily basis today than a kid who lived in the 1200s would have seen his entire life. And so one of the most important tools that kids need is the ability to spot, it's what Nancy Piercy calls a baloney detector, to spot nonsense or to spot wrong or evil when they see it. And also, I live in Colorado. I mean, Colorado Springs is a very divided place. You have everyone who loves Focus on the Family and everyone who hates Focus on the Family. And there's nobody in the middle in Colorado Springs. And so you walk down the street, we're going to have gay moments on the street. We've had gay moments on airplanes as we've flown back and forth across the country. Have you noticed the gay moments in commercials have been noticeably more? And so our approach is going to be, now, would that be my approach with, you know, am I saying that's how everyone should do it? No. Would that be my approach if my kids were 4 or 5? No. They're 11, 9, and 7. And we've, by the way, this isn't the first time we had that conversation either. When the Obergefell decision came out from the Supreme Court, my wife and I talked about it, came out on Friday, remember that? On Sunday night, we sat down with our daughters, and I said, hey, we need to tell you about something that happened in our nation today. Is that our, you know, governments don't always make a great decision. And the Supreme Court actually decided that something was legal that actually doesn't exist. And here's what they decided. And here's what Jesus said about it in Matthew 19. And my middle daughter was like, what? No one would ever do that. And I said, no, people have done that. People have decided that two men and two women, or that they wanted to marry another man or another woman. And here's why, and here's what's behind it. And I didn't plan to have a conversation about same-sex marriage with my 10-year-old, 8-year-old, and 6-year-old, but I wanted to have the conversation with them before somebody else did. So anyway, all that to say, not everyone agreed with me on Facebook. Probably not everyone agrees with me in this room. It was a pretty heated discussion on Facebook last night, but that's all right. I also completely understand those who feel like their kids are not ready for that moment, or they don't feel equipped to have that conversation with their kids about that moment. And if that's the case, two things. I get it. Don't go. And number two, get equipped to have a conversation with your kids about that moment. We all at least need to agree on that. If we don't have the conversation with our kids about identity, about sexuality, one of the things we talk about, sorry, I'm rambling, but one of the things we talk about in the book is in section 2 and section 3 are different. Section 3 is what we call the pounding waves of culture. These are the ones we feel, right? Like when you're at a beach and then a wave hits you and another wave hits you, right? You know, same-sex marriage, racial tension, pornography, Twitter and Facebook and social media, right? Transgenderism. These are the individual issues. And in our new book, we have about 14 chapters on 14 different issues that are just pounding us and how to think about them and how to talk to them with your kids. But that's section 3 are those 14. Section 2 are what we call undercurrents, right? C.S. Lewis said that the most dangerous ideas in a society aren't the ones that are argued, but the ones that are assumed. The ones that go unnoticed. Does that make sense? Beauty and the Beast is not going to steal your kids. You know, a gay moment of Beauty and the Beast is not going to steal your kids' hearts. What's going to steal their hearts is the undercurrent in which identity in our culture is assumed to be self-determined. Does that make any sense? We think identity is self-constructed and self-created. We think we are something by the mere fact that I asserted that I am something. We think that, you know, like for example, when it comes to words like parents or sexual partners or male and female, on those three things, on those three issues of identity, sexual partners, male and female, and parents, we think that genitalia is suddenly irrelevant to that conversation. That we can say what we are as if we don't have any parts, right? This is like saying gravity doesn't exist. Does that make sense? So my point here is what's going to get our kids are these unseen undercurrents that are just completely redefining a word that's so important, like identity. What does it mean to be human? Right? Who are we? And so the transgenderism issue and the LGBT, all the other LGBT issues are expressions of that, right? So anyway, got me in a lot of trouble.
Okay, so related to that, we have a bright intern at Center for Arizona Policy, Kayleen Swift, who's a student at Grand Canyon, and I had asked our interns if they had questions, and Kayleen had a question that I think is somewhat, you're talking about how we work with our kids. Kayleen's question goes more to how we as Christians go out in the public. Kayleen, do you have the microphone, or can somebody give her the microphone and have Kayleen answer her question, ask her question?
My question was, as Christians, we face so many controversial issues that pertain so much to our faith. How, as Christians, are we supposed to take on these issues and look different to the world so that they actually listen to our argument instead of just blow it out of proportion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And by the way, my nephew's going to Grand Canyon next year. So anyway, is it a good school?
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know. That's a great question. And there's a lot of different layers to that. I mean, one of the first layers to that is just the mere fact that we care about important issues sets us apart from a lot of our culture. We often think, for example, that the only struggle is between those of us that are pro-life and those that are pro-abortion. In reality, the other whole group we're dealing with are those that just don't care enough to engage the issue at all, right? There was an article in the New York Times years ago talking about, there's so much conversations about whether you're an atheist or a theist, whether you believe in God or whether you don't believe in God. The author said, "I'm an apatheist. I just don't care." And isn't that really one of the issues that we struggle with? You probably see it on the campus of a college or university the size of Grand Canyon. We certainly see it. I mean, you know, you guys that do policy all these times, one of the biggest issues is just getting Christians and getting people to care. Right? And so I want to be clear on, you know, what on that point, because one of the best ways you can engage is just to care about issues that matter. There's a great quote from Vince Lombardi, the great football coach. He said, "I'm not afraid to lose. I'm afraid to win at something that doesn't matter." And I think that that's one of the first things, is care about things that matter. This is why the scriptures talk about us primarily not as believers, people who believe, but people who love. And when you talk about love, you're talking about caring, and you're talking about passion, and you're talking about thinking about the best of other people. And so I think, don't underestimate the power of just caring in a culture that is distracted to death, right? So that's number one. Number two is when you do get into this conversation with those who do actually care but are on the other side. I love their line from Father Sirico, who's the head of the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids. He said, "We have to be ruthless with ideas and gentle with people." And the reason that that's the case is, you've heard this phrase. It comes from a book by a guy named Richard Weaver. Ideas have consequences, right? Here's the thing that should drive us. Yes, ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims, right? So the thing that should drive us, Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love God, and then the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor. If I really love my neighbor, I have to care not only about them, I have to care about the ideas that are in society that's victimizing them, lying to them, misleading them, you know, impacting the next generation. And that's the, and isn't that the story of the Good Samaritan? When Jesus is asked, okay, how do I love my neighbor? What Jesus tells is a story about the Samaritan, right? Somebody on the other side, culturally. Somebody on the other side of the audience, culturally, religiously, almost everything. And who are the two bad guys in that story? It's not the robber. It's the priest and the Levite who walks around the people, you know, the beaten, bloodied man, and say, "Hey, come to church." Right? The hero of the story is the Samaritan who gets down and gets his hands bloody and muddy, like Jesus did, by the way, in God becoming flesh, taking on our sin and suffering, right? And so there's just that idea of engaging. So number one, just care. And number two, remember that when you engage, what you're dealing with are victims of bad ideas, not just the ideas. Does that make any sense? That's huge. And then the third thing I'll say is that you can develop skills. This is something that, you know, we sometimes forget. I don't know how to talk about those issues in public. Well, learn. I don't know the right arguments. Read a book. You know, I speak to a lot of students, and some students are like, oh, that's over my head. I'm like, yeah, you're too short. I don't have an attention span. Grow one, you know. In other words, we're not victims of our ignorance. And there really is an age of information. This is one of the things we talk about in the book, which you can pre-order on Amazon. Is that one of the things we talk about there is in an information. It's interesting. We have at our fingertips more. There's more computing power in this than what sent a man to the moon. It's insane. I'm reading a book by Thomas Friedman on this right now. It will blow your mind. Here's the net result of that is that this makes us apathetic. I don't have to learn anything. I can Google it. I don't have to actually think through it. And then T.S. Eliot years ago wrote about this. And of course, this was back in the 30s when he's writing this in a play called The Rock. And it was a song in The Rock. He goes, where's that would have been a good one if I could remember it. It goes something like this. Where's all the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where's all the knowledge we have lost in information? Having more information than any other generation on the earth has not translated into having wisdom. And it makes us apathetic. And so, you see that the thing that I'm telling you is we need to engage culture is the onus is on us, right? Number one, care about things that matter. Number two, realize that you're dealing not just with ideas, but the victims of those ideas. And the person across the aisle from you, on the other side of this issue, right, are people themselves that are victims of bad ideas. They may be self-imposed victims, but they're still victims of bad ideas, and we need to find ways to love them and care for them. Because, again, the most true thing about them is they're made in the image and likeness of God. Their dignity is not acquired because they agree with us. Their dignity is inherent because of how God made them. And so we start there. And then third is get good at it. Learn skills. And I think Breakpoint can help with that, honestly, because every day on Breakpoint, we'll tackle an issue like doctor-assisted suicide. And then we'll end with, what do you need to do about it? How can you use this? What can you say to your friends and neighbors? What's the question? We want Breakpoints to be repeatable and usable. Right? Because we're just plagiarizing other people anyway. So you plagiarize us and we'll all forgive each other. Okay?
Well, and what you just said, I also heard when you spoke in January at the Evangelicals for Life conference, what you just said, you had the umbrella of civility. Yeah. And when we talk, there's so much chatter out there about civil discourse and how we communicate. And that's the quote I had from you from then. You did a Sirico quote. With civility is realizing every single person is made in the image of God and worthy of redemption. And that's what we're talking about. So this is kind of an interesting lead-in into our president. I didn't really plan it this way, but, I went to the meeting in Manhattan with 1,000 evangelicals, but you went to the meeting with only, 25 in a room with President Trump. Just your thoughts about what's going on. You know, we're very interested and concerned of wanting the president to issue this executive order on religious freedom, and it appears to be on the back burner now from what I can tell. It kind of exploded into the public domain, and then it's been pulled back. The thinking is that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is the one that's stopping it from moving forward. But just your impressions from when you were in that small group meeting and then what you see happening.
Great question. Yeah, so about 30 of us were in a room with the president, at that point the candidate, at Trump Tower, and the topic was religious liberty. And the individuals that were specifically invited, although some other individuals invited themselves and kind of imposed themselves on the meeting, I know that never happens to you, but the individuals that were invited were very skeptical. You know, this was a whether, we weren't kind of the 100% behind Trump
but
at this point.
But some never-Trumpers.
There were some never-Trumpers, right. And there were some of us that were in the middle, and then there were actually some who were very pro-Trump. And it was a really strategic gathering to have those three groups because we all agreed on religious freedom. And we all agreed that what we were hearing from Donald Trump at that point about religious freedom wasn't really where the issues were. Early on in his campaign, Donald Trump surrounded himself with individuals who really made the Johnson Amendment the lead issue. Now, the Johnson Amendment, as many of you know, is this idea that pastors can't promote politics from the pulpit. And I think it's a bad idea. I think it's silly. I think pastors should be able to say what they want. So I'm not for the Johnson Amendment. I hope it goes away. I just don't think repealing the Johnson Amendment actually deals with the main problems we face when it comes to religious freedom in our culture. Does that make sense? And so when we sat down, that was the first thing he said, the Johnson Amendment, and we're going to say Merry Christmas. I don't know who kept telling about Merry Christmas, but man, he just was on that, right? I didn't know it was illegal to say Merry Christmas. So anyway, we talked through. Now, it was interesting because what we found was a candidate who was, a couple things struck me, and I'll just be as honest as I can here. Number one is that he listened. He's very good in those meetings. He is very, very good in those meetings. He looks you in the eye. He listens. He wants to hear. The second thing that I heard, and I think it's just a reality we need to get used to as conservatives, is he's a brutally pragmatic man. Does that make sense? Now, this isn't necessarily bad when you're talking about getting things done, right? And we've seen that. He is pragmatic. So as we went and started clarifying, okay, the Johnson Amendment matters, but what really matters is not whether pastors can preach politics from the pulpit. What really matters is if everyday Christians can live out of their deeply held beliefs in the public square. If bakers and florists and photographers and wedding chapel owners and doctors and doctor-assisted suicide and so on, if they can live out, that's really where religious conscience. This is the difference between freedom of worship and freedom of religion. We walked through that with them. And he listened, and then he immediately looked over into the corner where there was a figure whose name you might have heard of, Steve Bannon, and said, "How's that polling? How's that polling? How's that polling?" Okay, now I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? Because here's why. If we'd have been in the room with the other candidate, it wouldn't have been as pragmatic. It would have been completely ideological, and it would have been completely opposed to everything that we were trying to argue. Does that make sense? What we have is in my understanding, when it comes to religious freedom, is a president who is persuadable, but not with us in terms of really understanding what religious freedom is. Here's the other thing, though, that was obvious, and it has become obvious in the State of the Union address. I've never heard a president get behind school choice in a State of the Union address like that.
And that it's the civil rights issue of our time.
The civil rights. No, I don't. Did even Reagan talk about it?
No,
that
but
moment?
I found a Romney quote that Romney used, said that education was a civil rights issue of our
he
day.
He just said education in general.
Education and talking about school choice. But certainly that was just as a candidate, and that was just to a select audience.
Right, and not the State of the Union. That was a remarkable moment. But he didn't say anything about religious freedom in that. I mean. So what do we know? What do we have? Number one, we have a candidate who is not going to issue out of the White House an executive order to impose a strange reinterpretation of Title IX on every school district in America. Right? That's what happened in the last administration. And for that, we can be grateful. Right? We can be very grateful that, and because part of that is what that means is, okay, we may not have in law the sort of protections from an executive order, which I still hope goes through, but it doesn't look very like it's a high priority at all. But he's not going to hunt us down. You're not going to have people hunted down. Now, that means it's not going to come from the federal level. It is still coming at the state level. Okay, the hunting down of photographers and so on and violations of civil rights codes. You see, all religious liberty right now, all those issues are local, not national anyway. So there's only so much that can help. The executive order would be really helpful, but we're not going to be hunted down. The third thing is Neil Gorsuch is a home run.
He's from Colorado, right?
He's from Colorado. Neil Gorsuch, this nominee for the Supreme Court. So when it comes to religious freedom issues, when it comes to the fact that, like we just had yesterday, the transgender case getting pushed back down to the courts in light of some of the changes in the administration, That buys time for a guy like Gorsuch to get nominated to be on the court. That's no small thing. That is no small thing. Gorsuch is a home run. It could not have been a better first pick in my view. That's what I think, and I can we can talk about that as well. So what did we get from Donald Trump? We got a guarantee. In that meeting, we got a guarantee of Supreme Court nominations, and he kept coming back to that, which he delivered on. We had a president that clearly was pragmatic, not ideological, when it comes to issues of religious freedom and social conservatism. So he's not with us ideologically, but he's not against us ideologically.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. And the pragmatism has to lead to, if indeed 80% of evangelicals voted for Trump and made the difference, was part of the difference in him getting elected, then the payback, to put it in blunt political terms, is that we get the executive order or we get more on religious freedom. We hope the pragmatic part of him takes over at some point on that. But the other thing to see, when you see the Johnson Amendment, to think about that just a minute, that meant that the pastors who wanted to support Trump, when he said, well, why aren't you endorsing me? They said, we can't because of the Johnson Amendment. So that just gives you insight into the present. Why is he fixated on that? Because it blocked pastors from endorsing him during the campaign. So that just shows another insight into his personality and his temperament, I believe. So it's just something to pray about, not to, you know, I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah, I'm not against the Johnson Amendment at all, like I said. It's just not the issue.
It's not enough.
It's not nearly enough. As a child of the Reformation, one of the key teachings of the Reformation is that all Christians are called into sacred vocations. Does that make sense? There's not a secular sacred. There's not Christians who are called into the ministry and then the rest of Christians who are not. It's that all Christians are called to be ministers of the gospel wherever they are. And we're unique in America to have a country where the very First Amendment enforces the right of people to see their own jobs, whether they're at Walmart or whether they're a plumber or whether they're a photographer or baker or whether they're a pastor, as a sacred calling that first and foremost they're allegiant to God and not the state. And we've lost that reality, that we have completely lost that. And what that is, it's no small thing. It's way more important than whether a pastor can talk about politics, because it basically says, where does religion belong? Does that make sense? Does it belong in the public square, or do you have to keep it in the... I remember 2009, Chuck Colson did a break point. I remember this one because I thought he was wrong at the time, and he's always right. So where he talked about the use of freedom of worship instead of freedom of religion from some of our government officials. And I thought he was just much ado about nothing. But he said, listen, in Cuba, in China, and even in North Korea, they have levels of freedom of worship, which is you can believe what you want in the privacy of your own mind and maybe in your own home and maybe in your own church. But so we've never had freedom of worship in America. We've had freedom of religion, which is you can believe what you want and live out of those deeply held beliefs in the public square. Do you see how different those two things are? All the challenges of religious freedom have been the attempt to push religion out of the public square as the public good. Which is why your question, by the way, was so important, because we show that religion belongs in the public square when we live out of our deeply held convictions in a way that's good for everybody, right? We do the best work when we are Hobby Lobby sorts of employees, right, or employers. We show that, but it's also why these attacks against photographers and bakers and florists really matter. This is why it drives me nuts when pastors say, oh, just bake the cake. Really? What if we said to you, just preach the sermon? No way, right? If you're responsible to God for the sermons that you preach, they're responsible to God for the cakes that they bake. All life is sacred because we live all of life, as Calvin said, before God. Sorry, that's a lot of theology, but I'll go.
No, we like that. And just by way of update, once I always have to bring in this, that, you know, we do not have a statewide non-discrimination law in Arizona. We only have 5 cities that protect, you know, someone against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The front page of the Arizona Republic yesterday was all about transgender and about how, you know, now all of a sudden they're coming up with all these examples of people who believe they were harassed. And I still need to read the full article in detail, but one of it was like someone who, you know, tried, you know, 40 applications to get a job. And I'm like, well, there are plenty of people in today's culture and job market who are doing 40 applications to try to get a job and not getting a job has nothing to do with whether they're transgender or not. It has to do with the economy and everything in the jobs market. But that's, you know, but the campaign is on here, certainly from the media, from the human rights campaign, all of that. And the minute George Soros or Paul Singer or some of these billionaires decide they're going to drop a few million in Arizona to put it on the ballot, that's when we're really dealing with it. And that's where, that's again where Breakpoint, we're out of time now, but we didn't even get to the Breakpoint talking about sexual orientation, gender identity versus religious freedom. And, you know, besides following John, you need to be following Ryan T. Anderson, because he's doing absolutely the best writing on these, what we call the SOGI laws and religious freedom and how that interplays and how we message and articulate you know, the balance of those freedoms and that type of thing. But Ryan T. Anderson is at Heritage Foundation. If you're on Twitter, if you're on Facebook, get on the Daily Signal. You know, the two emails to get, besides CAP emails, of course, that you should always be opening, would be the Breakpoint and the Daily Signal from Heritage Foundation, because that's the way I keep the most up to date on what's going on in the culture and that type of thing. Brief closing comments, and then Chris will come up and close us out.
Thanks so much. By the way, let me just say, too, I just think it's so important. One of the things we spent a lot of time talking about over the last couple of years and that Chuck really believed in is that cultural engagement has to go local. And that's what CAP represents. Here's what I mean by that. For years, Christians have shook their fist at Hollywood and D.C. and talked about how bad things are. And then we've then we've professionalized cultural engagement, right? We've blessed these individuals to go engage the culture for us in D.C. and Hollywood. And by the way, there are people called to D.C. and Hollywood like Ryan Anderson and so on. And absolutely send those people, make them do it. But the trick is we have to deprofessionalize cultural engagement. All of us are called as Christians to engage culture. And that begins by believing that culture is not just top down, culture's middle out. And so all the local issues that Kathy has talked about, she needs you. And you need CAP to exist. And that's why I love anytime Kathy says, hey, come do something here. I try to, because we believe that the trick, the secret sauce, is when Christians actually engage their own local cultures and to take that seriously as part of their own discipleship process and obedience to Jesus. Let me also just say this. I was supposed to, and I failed, to bring some handouts to give all of you. I just left them. I caught a late flight last night, and I blame it on Frontier. If you ever flew Frontier, yeah, it's always their fault. But I will say this. On that last point of engaging culture locally and deprofessionalizing it, making us all cultural engagers, years ago, Chuck was asked about his legacy. Chuck Colson was, and he was challenged at his legacy not just be an organization or a product or an a building, but that it be a group of people. And so Chuck started training 100 to 125 people every single year in a deep dive program in worldview, local leadership, and cultural engagement. And it's a program that takes you deep into the best Christian worldview thinking. It lets you engage with some of the best Christian worldview thinkers out there personally through residencies, reading books, and so on. And it's called we now call it the Colson Fellows Program. We're taking applications right now. This is my strongest commercial that I'm going to make for it. It's not for everybody. It's a year-long deep dive, about 10 to 20 hours a week of study, of interaction online, 3 weekends where you get together and a residency format. I know I met Colson Fellows here. Raise your hand. There's a couple that are here. Anybody else gone through the program in the past? No? I know Steve and Tina would have, but they had to leave early. If you're interested in going deep, if you're interested in taking this seriously, being around other believers who really want to engage culture at the same level, who want to be able to speak and to write and to teach and to mentor and to integrate their deeply held convictions into their businesses and family life and so on, take a look at that program. I'm going to give you a website where you can find the information that I was supposed to bring you in print. Colson Fellows, Colson Fellows, Fellows, ColsonFellows.org. Take a look at that. We'd love for you to consider signing up. Our current class will be commissioned. They don't graduate. We commission them in May, and the next class will begin sometime late summer and go throughout next, essentially, school year. Does that make sense? So Colson Fellows, take a look at that. Thanks.